This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Micro Mastery. Learn small, learn fast, and find the hidden path to happiness by Robert Twigger. Read for you by Roy McMillan.
The Memory of Rabia Basri, 714-801. The creative scientist needs an artistic imagination. Max Planck, 1918 winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics. What is micromastery? Start with the egg, not the chicken. YouTube has clips of The Great Egg Race, a long-running TV show in the 1980s hosted by an amiable German-born egghead called Dr. Heinz Wulff. Like a forerunner and more inventive version of Scrap Heap Challenge, contestants had to build a gadget with limited resources to meet the challenge set out at the start of the show. In the early series, all the tasks involved an egg that mustn't be broken, the first task being to make a machine to transport an egg the furthest distance possible using only paper clips, card, and rubber bands. It was such a simple idea, yet it gave rise to incredibly inventive machines. And it all started with an egg, something rather small and humble. Life can be overwhelming. We want to do as much as we can, see the world, learn new things, and it can all get a bit too much. I reached a point in my life when I felt that I could no longer be interested in everything. I had to shut some of life out, and I didn't like that. I was living under the assumption, the false assumption as it turned out, that to know anything worthwhile took years of study, so I might as well forget it. But something inside me rebelled. I still wanted to learn new things and make new things. They didn't have to be big things. I was happy to leave that till later. Start small. Start humble. Start with an egg. So I was thinking about how long it would take to learn how to cook really well. I recalled a chef telling me that the real test is doing something simple, like making a perfect omelette. Everything you know about cooking comes out in this simple dish. So I decided to switch the order around. Instead of spending 10,000 hours learning the basics of cookery and then showing my expertise in omelette making, I'd start with just making an omelette. I really focused on making that omelette. I separated it from the basic need that cooking usually fulfills, filling my stomach, so that it now occupied a special, singular place in my life. It had become a micromastery. A micromastery is a self-contained unit of doing, complete in itself, but connected to a greater field. You can perfect that single thing, or move on to bigger things, or you can do both. A micromastery is repeatable and has a success payoff. It's pleasing in and of itself. You can experiment with the micromastery because it has a certain elasticity. You can bend it and stretch it, and as you do, you learn in a three-dimensional way that appeals to the multisensory neurons in our brain. It's the way we learn as kids. You never absorb all the fundamentals straight away. You learn one cool thing, then another. You learn a 360 on a skateboard or how to make a crystal radio. My father was a teacher, and he hoped to encourage me when he told me that he would buy me the parts to make a transistor radio when I could explain how a transistor worked. My interest died immediately. I knew how to make the radio and have fun with it, but having to explain it was something difficult, adult, and alien. And wrong. Dad, I forgive you. Hungarian psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi has written extensively about flow. A state in which time seems to be suspended because our interest and involvement in what we're doing are so great. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, Harper Perennial, 1990. A micromastery, because it is repeatable without being repetitious, has all the elements that allow us to enter a flow state, which produces great contentment and enhances physical and mental health. Learning a micromastery doesn't commit you in that deadening way that buying a beginner's textbook does. By its limited nature, it gives you permission to remain interested in the world. It doesn't mean you have to commit to doing that thing for what feels like forever, and at the same time, it spares you any worries that you've wasted your time. Do you know the feeling of doing an introductory course on something which you give up on, and then a few years later try to tell others what you learned but you can't remember? A micromastery isn't like that. It's with you forever. And it's nice to have something to show others. For instance, if you learn a martial art, you need something to shut people up with when they say, "Go on, show us a move." A micromastery has a structure that connects in a crucial way to important elements in the greater fields it is a part of. It reveals relationships and balances in the elements of the task that mere words and explanation, textbook style, cannot. Its repeatability and gameability, people like that omelette, ask for another, you start to aim higher, turn it into a self-teaching mechanism where experimentation within certain defined limits greatly increases your learning. But let's get back to starting with an egg, or two. Here's how to make that omelette. Separate two eggs. Trap the yolk in one half of the shell. Room temperature eggs are best. Beat the whites to make a foamier mix. Heat the pan, medium to high heat. Blend the yolks back into the mix. 1 teaspoonful of oil, 1 teaspoon-ish of butter into the pan. Pour in the eggs, use a fork to keep mixing, agitate the pan on the stove. Score lines in the mix with a fork. Let the mix flow to fill in the gaps. Fold it in half. You can also fold it into thirds. Heat for a few moments more, then serve. Before taking it off the heat, watch it rise a little. Once you've done that, you can start experimenting. 1 egg, or 2, or more. Vary the heat. Change the fork action. Beat it less. Use all butter or all oil. A chef gave me the tip about using the fork to bulk up the omelette. I kept practicing. I went online and found more tips. Then a French woman told me about separating the yolk from the white, which allows your omelette to double in thickness and softness. When it's served, people simply go, "Wow." This is what I call the entry trick. Every micromastery has one. It is a way in one stroke to elevate your performance at that task and get an immediate payoff, a rush of rewarding neurochemicals, which is a nice warm feeling. In some micromasteries, the entry trick is huge, an integral part of the whole thing. In others, it just gives you enough of a push to get you going. There are lots of big-shot learners out there boasting of their ability to master foreign languages, get calculus down, or absorb C++ programming. But they all seem to miss this point. Learning must not be like school. It must not be boring. It doesn't need to be silly fun, but it mustn't be deadening or dull or too hard. The entry trick, in one fell swoop, sweeps all that away. A great entry trick is used in stone balancing. Maybe you've seen some stone sculptor type doing it at the beach. It looks like magic. Rounded rocks and mini boulders balancing on each other in a seemingly impossible way. The first time I saw such a sculpture, I thought it had to have glue or metal rods inside it, and then I watched a small boy knock it over. When I attempted to help rebuild it, the sculptor showed me the entry trick. You can balance any stone at all, but you must find 3 raised bits close together on one side of the supporting stone. 3 bumps, 3 nodules, or even 3 grains. They can be tiny, almost invisible. In fact, the smaller they are, the better it looks. These 3 bumps act as a flat triangle for another curved object to fit into. That's how you make these crazy balances work. People look for flat bits on the stones to make them stand on each other, but that doesn't work, because nothing in nature is really flat. Stone balancing is not only fun, but also a perfect form of micromastery. It is complete in itself, but it could also lead you further into the greater world of sculpture and outdoor art, should you want to go there. The trick is to find 3 bumps on one side. These form a triangle you can balance the stone on. If you only have 2 bumps, you can cheat. You can insert a tiny, tiny piece of grit as a 3rd bump. Perfectly regular stones can be great. It looks so smooth because it's regular. But if you look really closely, it's actually rough and lumpy. Another trick is to balance 2 stones at once. This way you can get some dramatic overhangs. Anyone can do it. We envy the person who has a perfect French accent, who can roll a kayak, perform a double or even triple integral in maths, or compose a poem that isn't laughable, who can draw something well, do a magic trick, or lay a brick wall that doesn't fall down. These are perceived as hard things to learn that signify a greater mastery of the field concerned. But with micromastery, you start with the test piece and then, and only then, do you go back upstream to explore more. Why? Because the biggest reasons for not achieving anything are giving up, failing to gain momentum, and becoming distracted. You may imagine you are tough and self-contained, but we all need a payoff as soon as we start learning, especially if it's been a while since we tried anything new. If you don't have micro-successes along the way, you'll lose heart and give up, especially if you're learning something on your own. Rapid learning techniques, intensive courses and shortcuts are all very well, but if you haven't got a show-offable product at the end, you'll give up. It's no good telling your friends and family that you have a broad knowledge of the background of maths or a working acquaintanceship with magic tricks. Come on, they'll say, show us something now. Having a micromastery gives you something to boast about, as loudly or as quietly as you like. It gives something to connect you to others and earn that all-important feedback. No man, woman, or child is an island, and yet we are taught as if we are solitary brain blobs who just suck up knowledge until one miraculous day we are masters, qualified, ready to teach, or some other spurious designation. We are not like that. Humans want to pass on what they've learned straight away, not 5 years later. Ask the experts. Those who have mastered their field are often a great source of insight, and I've talked to many such experts to produce the micromasteries outlined in this book. They often approach their subject from a perspective I'd never have thought about. When I spoke to former England Schools rugby player and coach of the Nigerian Sevens team, Rupert Selden, he didn't, as I'd expected, suggest spin passing as a micromastery of his sport. He preferred the drop kick, a more technical skill. A Madame Tussauds sculptor told me how modelling a human skull from clay, or even plasticine, is a micromastery that starts you on the path to producing lifelike sculptures. He explained how you see the skull beneath the skin when you look at someone you want to model. Usually, I combine asking an expert with my own research. Having learned traditional martial arts in Japan, I already knew that the Japanese use kata and self-contained exercises, micromasteries, in most of their teaching. The Japanese approach to learning, be it martial arts, the tea ceremony, or calligraphy, is different from Western methods of teaching. In the West, the tacit assumption is that you either start very young, possibly driven by obsessive parents, or you have an innate talent. Teaching is conceived as a kind of coaching, and if you haven't got the talent, you're considered a lost cause. The Japanese know that talent is rather overrated. More important is your attitude to learning. So their method of teaching assumes that everyone can learn, whatever their initial level of skill. Instead of hoping that students pick it up by osmosis, as is done in the West, micromastery routines are devised so that everyone, even the apparently talentless, can learn. Drawing is a good case in point. Lots of people swear they can't draw, but that usually means they can't draw a picture that looks like someone. This is like saying you can't cook when you haven't ever read a recipe book or bought any ingredients. You have to start a few stages further back with something simple, something humble. Shu Rayner, who has illustrated hundreds of children's books, has a website dedicated to helping people learn to draw. When I talked to him, he emphasized that all objects can be reduced to simple shapes, cubes, spheres, and cylinders, and these can be even further reduced to lines and curves. He said, "If you can draw a line, you can draw. The next step is to draw straight lines and then curved lines, which is where Zen circles come in. Zen monks draw endless circles. Some are good. Some are not so good. The thing I like to look for first is the entry trick, the piece of insider information that elevates your initial attempt above that of the average first-timer and shows you the way into the micromastery. With circle drawing, there are not one, but three tricks to get you going. Trick number one. Hold your pen higher. Trick number two, use the arm, not just the wrist. Keep the wrist off the desk. Trick number three, rest hand on fist. Move both as you draw. With these tricks, you can experiment and get better and better. Holding your pencil, pen, or ideally brush midway down its handle is the single easiest way to improve drawing. The further you can move your gripping finger and thumb from the point, the easier you will find it. There will be a miraculous improvement over the crabbed, nib-pinching style many of us have developed from our school days. Holding the pen higher up will improve not only all your drawing, but also your handwriting. You can then try lifting your hand off the table and using your whole arm, rather than just your hand isolated at the wrist, to make the circle. The neurological reason for doing this is that a greater area of the brain is being stimulated, so the learning is deeper and, ultimately, a greater refinement of movement is possible. Classical guitarist David Leisner claimed that he recovered from focal hand dystonia, the repetitive strain illness that often affects guitarists, by retraining using his whole arm instead of just his wrist. This not only aided his recovery, but also, amazingly, improved his performances. Another entry trick, beloved by sign writers who need to get very accurate curves and circles, is to rest your drawing hand on your fist. Make the circle by using a combination of moving the drawing arm while also moving the fist to guide it. You can experiment with how much you move the supporting fist. Seeing the world in terms of micromasteries makes anything seem possible. Fancy bookbinding, yoga, tap dancing, or tank driving all have their micromasteries. It's very liberating. You no longer have to feel trapped in whatever your day job happens to be. You will start in a small way, a humble way, to get your life back from the idea the world seems to push on us that we should do just one thing all our lives. Inside a micromastery. When you've seen someone start a fire in the woods using just their hands and a wooden drill, or cook a perfect omelette, or lead you in a snappy tango across the dance floor, you don't forget it easily. These skillful activities all look hard, but the difficulty is made manageable by using the structure necessary to achieve them. Every micromastery has a precise structure. 1. The entry trick. 2. The rub-pat barrier. 3. Background support. 4. The payoff. 5. Repeatability. 6. Experimental possibilities. Knowing the structure helps you learn the micromastery, and also helps you identify other things as potential micromasteries. It enables you, on approaching a new subject of study, to identify for yourself the parts of it that can be micromastered, thus speeding up the learning and increasing your chances of sticking with it. 1. The entry trick. We've seen how the trick is your way in, your leg up. The entry trick overcomes the barriers to getting started that all new micromasteries present. Some of these have to do with confidence and familiarity, and some have to do with giving the right amount of emphasis to each part of the process. The entry trick is a quick way to get a basic grip on the matter. You may in the end not need to use it, but at first it's your best friend. It could be a simple methodological change, like holding the pen higher or separating the egg yolk from the white before making an omelette. Or it could be setting out to focus on one area of training. The trick to standing up on a surfboard is to practice jumping up onto the board on your living room floor. When doing a 360-degree turn on a skateboard, you turn the eyes and head first and the body follows. The trick could be a number of things to pay special attention to. In making fire with a bow drill, you need everything to be bone dry and as far off the ground as is practicable. It's amazing how moisture congregates close to the ground. Don't worry if this seems like a bit of a rush through some intriguing micromasteries. We'll come back and deal with them all in part two of this book. The trick is what sucks you in and then suckers you in. You tell yourself that if you know the trick, you can already do it. Knowing this helps the hours of practice, if not fly by, then at least pass with tolerable speed. Some micromasteries have several tricks. We saw that in drawing Zen circles, you can change the pen grip or rest one hand on top of the other. Some have a rather subtle trick. In street photography, it is simply get closer. With this single focus, your photographs will improve exponentially. You might reach a point when you discover that you don't need the trick anymore, but it's done its work by then, pulling you in enough for you to perfect the micro mastery. 2. The rub pat, or countervailing skill, barrier. Many of the tricks which are used to get a head start connect to the rub pat barrier, also known as the countervailing skill barrier, at the heart of micro mastery. This is the point where you will find two skills needed for the task start to work against each other. The name comes from the difficulty of both rubbing your stomach and patting your head at the same time. At first sight, it appears easy. Then you try and find it almost impossible. Finally, you focus more on one than the other, keeping one going and then bringing the other in slowly until you succeed. We tend to think of skills acquisition in a simplistic way. You just pile one on top of the other, don't you? But skills can either help the mastery of further skills or actually retard such mastery. We think of something complex like learning to drive as a task of coordinating several skills. But it's also useful to go through each skill and see how it actually messes with the others. Changing gear interferes with steering. It doesn't help it in any way. Better to perfect each independently rather than suffer the consequences of doing them poorly together. The rub-pat barrier is where this kind of contradiction is most heightened. It's the highest hurdle you'll have to leap when learning something new. If you can clear it, you're more than halfway home. Isolating the countervailing skills is a very useful exercise. It takes the mystery and scariness out of learning something new. It allows you to break a new subject down into manageable chunks. In any attempt to learn something worthwhile, you'll hit rub-pat skill barriers. This task of coordinating different pathways in the brain. But being able to shift focus isn't always easy. Often the task overwhelms us and we panic and give up. "I just don't get it," we plead. Fast learners unconsciously focus on each element in turn when they learn new things that seem hard. It can make them seem a little pedantic, but you cannot build awareness if you hurry. You need to be outside time. I find if I allow 2 hours for any learning session, I quickly forget about time and things start to flow. But if I assign less time, I begin to rush. The entry trick also helps here. It lessens the impact of conflict of skills and assists in balancing them. Just knowing that this barrier exists will make it easier to conquer the micromastery. It will focus your efforts. Back to the Zen circle. The rub-pat barrier here is not too bad, though it stumps some people who have been convinced, or convinced themselves, they can't draw. The two elements that vie with each other and need to be balanced are the slow pace required to make a detailed and careful line versus the speed and flair needed to make a good curve. Slow down too much and your circle will look like an amoeba. Speed up too much and you'll get an egg-shaped flourish with sticking out ends like the hair on a cartoon character's head. Some micromasteries have low rub-pat barriers. They're quite easy to get started on. In stone balancing, once you know the entry trick and have a good supply of stones, the rub-pat barrier becomes apparent only when you realize that the crazier the balance, the harder it is to build on. You need to coordinate spotting tiny bumps and balance spots with visualizing an entire tower of stones. A really good balance spot for 3 stones may throw a 5-stone tower out of kilter. Moving the stones back and forth so that you have a subunit that balances before making that balance on top of another stone really is like rubbing your stomach and patting your head. For others, the rub-pat barrier is the main obstacle to doing the thing at all. Juggling has an obviously high rub-pat barrier. You need to be able to throw and catch with each hand pretty much at the same time. The trick is to focus on throwing for a while, then focus on catching. By separating and building the skills, you grow the neural pathways involved so that you are better able to operate on autopilot. If you like, assign a score to how much you are focusing on one rather than the other, or your competence level at each skill. Maybe you are a 9 on throwing and only 2 on catching. Numbering the inner elements of a skill, worked out at length in Timothy Galway's excellent Inner Game series of books, is a great way to take the pressure off trying harder at both skills at once. When we try too hard to crack the rub-pat barrier, it usually just results in frustration. Better to keep coming back to it and continually revising the numbers assigned to each countervailing skill. The Eskimo roll, a technique used by paddlers to right a capsized kayak while remaining inside it, may look scary at first, but the rub-pat barrier of using the hips to flip up the boat in conjunction with the hands can easily be separated. You can rock the boat up against a dock while holding on to the firm surface and practice using the hips in this controlled way. By identifying the rub-pat barrier in advance, you can offset a lot of its terror. Going to the level higher than you want ultimately to achieve is connected to an Aikido training skill called Hajime training. In Hajime, which means begin in Japanese, you simply do each technique as fast as possible. Doesn't matter how badly you do it, as long as you go at top speed. This forces you into a flow state and makes conscious thinking impossible. You then alternate this with doing the technique as slowly as possible. The variation builds awareness and loads the basic countervailing skill deep into the brain. Performing countervailing skills means using two parts of your brain at once. The brain likes to do one thing at a time if you insist on being conscious about it, but if you can let go of thinking, you'll find you can master very complex skills that require using multiple parts of the brain simultaneously. Thinking, by which I mean verbalizing in your head and following these instructions, is a surefire way to look like a dummy. The faster you can get a feel for something and just do it, the better. Guidelines can be useful, of course. When you learn to drive, instructors sometimes put marks on the car's back window, which you can line up with the edge of the curb in order to parallel park perfectly every time. After a while, though, you get to sense exactly where you are. You can do it by eye. This always seems amazing to newcomers to an art, but actually we're excellent at doing things by eye. In the 19th century, wheelwrights would make perfect wheels not by measuring, but by using their highly attuned sense of natural measurement alone. Doing it by eye means trusting our own ability to use a countervailing skill. 3. Background support. Before making any attempt at learning a micromastery, you need to give yourself the best chance to succeed. You need good equipment or tools, time, and an open mind. You should not be in a hurry. Even think about making use of downtime. The comedian and actor Steve Martin learned to play the banjo by placing one in every room in his house, including the bathroom. You need to remove all obstacles in your way. Sometimes the right bit of kit is the one that helps demolish the rub-pat barrier. In free diving, for example, the rub-pat barrier is balancing the rate of descent against pressure in the ears. Go too fast and your ears will hurt like hell. Go too slow and you won't get anywhere. For many, the breakthrough is aided by a simple piece of kit, Docks Pro Plugs, as also used by musicians, which let water in slowly through a small hole, thus equalizing the pressure more smoothly and, incidentally, reducing the chance of ear infections. In street photography, the rub-pat barrier is speed versus shake or blur. This can be offset by having a small camera with very fast focus. In any case, having the right kit means the right kit for you. The kit that inspires you to keep practicing again and again. In film photography, some are drawn to the off-the-wall use of instant coffee and vitamin C as a developing agent. Yes, it works. Although it's more hassle than using a commercial developer, it's the right kit in the sense that it's fun and intriguing. For Zen circles, it helps to have a pen you really like using. Artists and illustrators tend to have their personal favorites. Shu Rayner likes to use a rotring pen, and writer-illustrator Dan Price uses a Japanese Sakura fiber tip. I've grown to love the Pentel brush pen used by manga artists. It seems to make Zen circles even more fun to do. But background support isn't just about kit. It includes the environment and people around you. My daughter was almost ready to give up the guitar, but we found another teacher, and she not only learned far faster, but is now also really keen. The right teacher makes a huge difference. They don't have to be brilliant. They just have to be able to make you want to do more of whatever you're interested in. Just as doctors aid the body to heal itself, teachers redirect our attention to help us teach ourselves. 4. The payoff. All micromasteries are structured with some kind of success payoff. It's what makes you want to repeat them. The fact that the micromastery looks hard, juggling, proving Pythagoras using origami, gives you an incentive, and whether your motivation is to look good or meet the inner challenge, or both, there needs to be a clear and unequivocal state of achievable success in a micromastery. That's why cooking is not a micromastery, but making an omelette is. Why driving isn't, but performing a handbrake turn is. Even why paddling a canoe isn't, but doing an Eskimo roll really is. There are degrees of sharpness and definition to the success involved. The sharper and brighter it is, the more applause you usually get. We all need attention. It's a vital form of human nourishment. In evolutionary terms, humans require others for survival throughout life, not just in infancy. We find it far easier to survive as part of a group than as an individual in the wild, and getting attention from others means we are a member of the gang. Of course, you need to be weaned off needing more attention than is healthy, but you still need some. Even the attention we give ourselves is a personal payoff, the nice warm feeling that we've done it, even if no one else knows about it. For some, the public payoff can be a strong motivating force. Coach and creativity teacher Steve Chapman announces his challenges publicly and uses the threat of humiliation to drive him forward. Laziness and distraction are overcome by fear, a clever case of using a negative quality to defeat other negative qualities. Simply being more useful can be a great motivator and give you the payoff you need. If you can cook great food, be entertaining, be more fun, able to fix things, that is reward enough. A micromastery leaves you feeling that you've achieved something, however tiny. I've found when drawing Zen circles that I often cover an entire page, but try to keep them from overlapping. The bubble effect adds to my payoff. 5. Repeatability. You have to be able to repeat a micromastery endlessly, so it cannot be too boring or inflexible or unchanging. Most importantly, you have to be able to get better at doing it. You repeat and repeat and watch yourself improve. It's really quite astonishing. I have set myself the micromastery of always drawing the cup, spoon and saucer whenever I go into a coffee shop. Sometimes I do it painstakingly, a real still life. Other times I'm in a diabolical hurry and dash the sketch off in under a minute. It doesn't matter, as long as I keep doing it, keep repeating this simple task. I can feel myself getting more confident, and I am seeing better, seeing more of what has always been there. Because even when I'm in a rush, I'm not in that semi-panic state of mind, which is part fear of getting it wrong and part fear that I won't finish it for some reason. These fears, a kind of small and personal performance fear, can dog even our most private and unpressured attempts to create or try something new. By having a set time and a repeatable format, you can drive away those devils of self-doubt. The holy grail of marketers is to make something gameable, which means repeatable and addictive by virtue of having a surprise ending. If it's too predictable, we get bored. No omelette is quite the same as another. Just as it is with a bout of juggling or a Zen circle, there is a chance the next one will be better. Herein lies gameability. For this to occur, it must be easy to repeat the micromastery. Novel writing is not a micromastery, but 100-word flash fiction writing is. Climbing Everest isn't, but scaling your local climbing wall is. 6. Experimental possibilities. A micromastery is like a miniature lab, a place to try countless experiments that will further your knowledge and lead you deeper into the subject in question. Experimentation is not the province of science. Science merely appropriates this deeply human form of curiosity. Through experimentation, you can give added zest to repeatability. You can improve exponentially, achieving something that would take eons of straight, repetitive, getting better practice. I decided long ago to micromaster the J-stroke for a canoe, used when you're at the back of the boat or alone in a Canadian canoe. The J describes the path of the paddle through the water as seen from above. I read up on it and started using it every time I went out on the nearby river. I couldn't really get it. Then I had a conversation with an expert, my cousin Simon, who was a former Olympic team canoeist. He told me with admirable self-deprecation that mostly he did a kind of sea stroke. I got it straight away. He had given me permission to experiment. Instead of trying to follow the instructions by the letter, I should have been having fun doing C, L, J, and maybe even Z strokes. I got better immediately, finding my own way to a more powerful paddling stroke. Every MicroMastery is there to be twisted, turned, done back to front, messed up, and generally had fun with. It's the way you learn the variables, how far they can be pushed, and how they affect each other. One of the grave errors of learning outcome-type teaching is that it moves too swiftly for endless experimenting and mucking about. Keep drawing circles, making skulls out of clay, doing wheelies on your bike. Forget learning outcomes, and come out and actually learn. Dynamic learning. Alexander Hopkins is a world-class maker of medieval-style musical instruments. He started when he was in his late teens, before he had any kind of training. He knew he wanted to make a violin, so he bought a book about instrument making, but he couldn't understand it. It just didn't make sense. In a fit of frustration, he decided to make a violin using just whatever he knew, copying pictures and hoping for the best. It was terrible. But then, when he went back to the book, he understood it. He made another violin, and this time it was really rather good. Books convey static learning, which is why highly practical and physical activities, such as martial arts, can't be learned from them. However, once you know something about martial arts, you can use a book to enhance your skills. Static learning is about following a sequence of steps. Dynamic learning is about the relationship between the steps and how much emphasis to give each one. As we've already discussed, we learn essentially by watching others. This is how we grasp the correct emphasis to apply to each step of what we're doing. Alexander Hopkins had no one to watch, but by making a rough version of a violin, he learned the rudiments of how much importance to attach to each part of the making process. In a sense, this first attempt was like a micromastery, a small nugget of dynamic learning. Confidence, center, balance. In addition to knowing the elements of a micromastery's structure, it's helpful to look at its dynamic relationship to confidence, center, and balance, which I find makes the whole task more real to me. I learned this from 8th Dan Aikido master Jacques Bailly. He teaches something very simple yet powerful. When you find where your physical center should be in any attack or defense, your balance improves. With improved balance, your confidence improves. When you have more confidence, you feel more sure of your center. It's a virtuous circle of improvement. It works the opposite way, too. When your confidence is shaken, you can't find your center, so your balance goes, which weakens your confidence and your performance declines. Finding your center when learning a micromastery can give you an injection of confidence and make it easier to comprehend. It is the place around which it all revolves. Obviously, this is more significant with some than others. What is the center of making an omelette? Sounds rather zen, but maybe just thinking about it will help you improve. In some micromasteries, it might help to think of the right stance, the right position, the right setup. But out of all of these, one thing will be of focal importance. With an omelette, it is the heat of the pan, which is a function of the stove's power, the kind of pan, and the type of fat used. The center is where you focus awareness. The center of the seemingly simple act of chopping wood is the axe handle, not the axe head. You feel the weight through the handle and react to that. Finding your center can be literal, as in surfing or dancing, or it can be metaphorical. It is almost always located at the rub-pat barrier. In drawing Zen circles, the balance point, as we've seen, is between the need to be accurate and the need to be smooth. The center is how you hold your arm, how it is positioned to address both these needs. Identify the effort hotspots. My ears were dribbling water, my eyes stung with chlorine. I had that sick feeling you get after ingesting too much water that too many people and canoes have been in. I had been rolling for hours, probably just 1 hour, but it felt like 10, and I had yet actually to do one successful standard Eskimo roll in my canoe. I was learning the hard way. There is a hard way and an easy, or at least easier, way to learn everything. And the easier way embraces all the so-called cheats and tricks needed to get you learning fast. MicroMastery aims to make learning easier, not harder, since the biggest obstacle to learning is giving up because it takes too long. When I started to learn how to do an Eskimo roll, the standard way to recover from a kayak capsizing without having to leave the boat, I was a teenager doing a scout course at the local swimming pool. The instruction was verbose, and we had nothing to connect it to. We saw our teacher do only a single roll in one of the tiny, snub-nosed kayaks. We didn't know how much effort to put into each step of the technique, so we were overexerting in all of them and tiring ourselves out. This is why many people fail. They don't know the effort hotspots. These hotspots can be identified in every activity, so you can learn how to throttle back and conserve energy when necessary, and blast out when you need to. Rope climbing is an instructive example. The trick with rope climbing is to use your arm strength only sparingly. If you don't, you'll never move more than a few feet upwards. As with all forms of climbing, your feet do the real work. With a thick gym rope, you can get enough grip by pressing the rope between your ankles. With thinner ropes, imagine an S-shaped loop with one foot in the top pushing down on the rope as it goes over the other foot in the lower rope loop. You learn to stand up on the rope with all the weight on your feet. You then move your hands up and simply dangle. The only arm strength involved is that which is needed to hang from the rope, not climb it. You then bring your feet up, lock them again onto the rope, and again stand high, your knees doing the raising of your weight. You have to concentrate your arm strength in the small bursts of activity as you raise your knees. The quicker you do this, the less arm strength you need. The more coordinated you are, the less arm and finger strength you need. By finding the effort hotspot, you succeed. There is a similar need for a burst of concentrated, coordinated strength in surfing. Riding a moving board isn't that hard, once you're standing on it. The hard part is getting up in a quick and easy move before the wave runs out or the board overbalances. If you go out to surf without isolating and practicing the single board standing move, you'll probably get tired and cold before you have a chance to use it. And then you'll never learn. In all these things, the Eskimo roll, rope climbing and surfing, the effort hotspot lies in the rub-pat barrier at the heart of each activity. And because each one requires a certain strength, it can look overwhelming. But it doesn't have to be. It's amazing how powerful a learning tool it can be to isolate the rub-pat barrier at the beginning. It establishes a hierarchy of effort for the MicroMastery. You simply don't have the strength to apply maximum force all the way through. You need the maximum at specific moments only. Are there any MicroMasteries that are learned slowly? Certainly some come quicker than others. But if you're having trouble learning a MicroMastery quickly, it may be because you've missed the effort hotspot, the fast way to conquer the rub-pat barrier at the center of it. Locate hidden MicroMasteries. They are everywhere. A MicroMastery must show a level of skill beyond the ordinary. It must look hard to do and leave people, including yourself, impressed by your achievement. The bigger the challenge, the more learning that's going on. Humans are learning animals, and when we aren't busy learning, then we are busy dying, to paraphrase Bob Dylan. As traveller, storyteller, writer and photographer Tahir Shah puts it, the only learning curve worth being on is a steep one. When you find yourself on a steep learning curve, you simply have to stop messing about and making excuses. It's sink or swim, and humans are good at swimming. So, you look for something hard to do. Let's take gardening as a completely random example. Growing a rare tropical plant from seed, grafting one type of orchid onto another to create your own hybrid. These are gardening MicroMasteries. But you could look further for MicroMastery ideas in well-written autobiographical accounts and picture-driven textbooks. The Education of a Gardener by Russell Page might be one place to start. Russell Page, The Education of a Gardener, Collins, 1962, reprinted Harville Press, 2014. But you have to read it in the right way. Anyone can give the advice, read a textbook, but can you read it with a micro-mastery hat on? The key is to look for things that are defined and limited in extent with a verifiable and obvious form of payoff. In micromastery, we are always looking to make something our own. Most other learning methods are impersonal, designed for an ideal beginner who doesn't exist in reality. Let's strip our arbitrary choice of gardening down to something really unpromising, lawn care, and see how the micromastery method works. Lawn care involves cutting the lawn, feeding the grass, getting rid of imperfections by reseeding, and rolling the grass. All pretty dull to me, except the last one, which conjures up an image of a giant roller I remember from school being used to keep the cricket pitch flat and manned by about 6 boys all huffing and puffing as they moved it, usually as a punishment for some transgression. I like the idea of this. Okay, I will micromaster rolling the lawn dead flat, maybe for croquet or bowls or a putting green. Rule 1. Locate the fun. Looking for where the fun is in an activity is the single best way to locate the micromastery that will work for you. It's your way in. Rolling was the only fun image I could conjure up, but I know that if I started researching and asking expert lawn carers, I'd find lots more micro-fun possibilities. When I returned to analog photography, I dutifully tried 35mm film, but it wasn't half as much fun as using a clunky old twin-lens camera shooting larger format 120mm film. I went where the fun was and devised a micromastery of shooting one film a day, giving me 12 images, which I contact printed onto a single A4 sheet and stuck in a diary album. I then annotated and drew on the pictures for more fun, using a white fiber-tip pen. Repeatable, experimental, I started using all kinds of film, including 20-year-old Russian film, and with a low rub-pat barrier, balancing exposure and other fiddles against time, which is always short in photography, all of this came from going where the fun was, using a wacky camera and larger negative film. I wanted to write fiction and spent a year fiddling about with a novel without making progress and simply getting more anxious. Then a friend suggested I write flash fiction and not get up from my desk until I'd completed a story. This sounded way more fun than puzzling over a giant, never-ending manuscript. I started writing 3 a day. It had become a micro-mastery for fiction writing. Over time, I learned the skills I needed to write longer pieces, and in the end, I did indeed write and publish a full novel. What we're talking about here is not just the difficulty of getting going with something new. We're talking about specific aspects that somehow chime more deeply with you than others. It's about making it your own. And the key is to listen to your instinctive likes and dislikes when you first approach it. When I started to get interested in drawing and began to look at artists' work, I found I instinctively liked the simple technical pen drawings of Dan Price. That looks like fun, and I can do that, I thought. The telltale signs that you've found a way in. It's easy to become dishonest about what you really like and don't like. Advertising bombards us with images that are designed to change our minds, as do movies, TV, shop displays, and the people we meet every day. Sometimes you need to get away and find out what you really like and dislike. A well-meaning artist pal of mine advised me to get drawing with charcoal, but childhood memories of charcoal were bad. I didn't want to go that way again. I needed something new as my way in. I found I liked the stark black-and-white drawings I had started on my annotated photographs, and that was my way in. Rule 2. Find the tail, and then the dog. The wagging tail is the fun, the way in. But you want to move up to the entire dog, the area you'd like to master or study. In our lawn care example, rolling leads to a flat lawn, which you want for outdoor games. But there may be patches of less dense grass. You'll need to reseed these and nurture them. You'll also need to mow the lawn finely, which means getting exactly the right piece of kit, one of those old-style drum mowers rather than a modern rotary. Now that I have my background support in the form of the right kit, and my payoff in having a perfect lawn, and my repeatability in needing to mow it often, I need to break mowing down into the entry trick and experimentation. The entry trick will be found by searching internet sites like YouTube and Instructables and asking expert lawnmowers of Bowling Greens what the secrets are. There may be more than one, almost always there is, and these will form the basis of my experimentation, all of which I can integrate with my rolling and planting. Wow, I'm getting really interested, and interested in a subject I've never even considered before. But let's try something completely different. How about international law? I know very little about it and have not much more than a passing interest in it. No doubt if I was personally involved in a case that would be different, but with MicroMastery we try to find a personal point of contact even if there isn't one initially. So, go where the fun is. Well, law involves precedents and cases, and these are essentially stories. So the way in for me will be about finding the craziest stories that are real cases in international law. I'll naturally want to relate these to others, which is a great way of memorizing them. This can be my entry trick, giving me a big advantage over someone plodding through huge lists on their own. What next? Rule 3. Go three-dimensional. Go multisensory. The latest research into neurological function reveals that much of our brain is composed of multisensory neurons. There isn't one type of brain cell for smell, another separate one for sight. All these inputs can be handled by the same cell. We learn better the more dimensions and senses we involve. So, in the somewhat arid world of international law, we need to find more senses and dimensions, which means meeting people, finding real situations, all easily achieved through the internet. Instead of reading, go to an asylum center and see what's going on. Talk to a deep-sea fisherman about where he can and cannot fish, and get some fish from him. Any sensory experiences associated with what we are learning enhance memory and cognition. Combining fun and three dimensions, I'd want to visit one of the many disputed islands in the world. Get on-the-ground experience of talking to the residents. If I couldn't travel, I'd speak on the phone, get them to send pictures. My MicroMastery might center around attempts to create a new country, Sealand, on an old gas platform in the North Sea, for example. I'd need repeatability, so how about creating a top trumps pack of cards featuring disputed islands and territories? You can see that playing fast and loose with all the various concepts of MicroMastery helps generate possibilities for future research and inquiry. This is the way you'll find a situation that you can structure using the six-point device of entry trick, rub-pat barrier, background support, the payoff, repeatability, and experimental possibilities. Rule 4. Talk to the experts. Before bolting the structure of a MicroMastery onto a new activity, you need to talk to people who really know about the subject. An expert, however, isn't quite who you might think. Someone who has done the job for 20 years has less expertise, in my view, than a newbie who has found something fun to do. Being able to find fun things to do with a computer program is a more useful form of expertise than knowing the program in some static sense. Children will often be great at finding the fun possibilities in a thing long before they understand it in a formal sense. Another level of expertise is found in people who are simply able to explain a thing, even though they're not able to do it. You may learn more about writing from an unpublished editor who knows how a story works than, say, a successful novelist who writes intuitively and can't tell you how to write well. What about drawing again? I'd been doing Zen circles for a while and started to look around for harder things to draw. I found I liked odd stuff like drawing Italian coffee pots and wicker chairs. Sometimes people were interesting to draw too, but none of these was really a MicroMastery. They were all too broad. I needed to identify a rub-pat barrier that I could focus on. After more experimentation, it dawned on me that primitive art looked a lot like my untutored attempts at drawing, and that the tried-and-tested method of repeating man's own evolutionary experience of learning a subject, start maths with Euclid, physics with Galileo, was a good idea. Immediately, I found a rub-pat barrier in flowing lines. All the great artists have lovely lines when they draw. They don't wobble or bend. They flow and arrive at exactly the right spot. Now, this skill is at its most basic in prehistoric art, so by copying examples of it using a rollerball or microfiber tip pen, I could practice, experiment, and improve at line drawing. I've found my micromastery. I have several books of cave art and Paleolithic art, and I love the sheer simplicity of the images and the sculptures. I don't claim to understand it. No one really can, as it dates from 10,000 to 30,000 years ago. Yet the images remain beautiful and interesting. Just as beginner artists find people and faces difficult, so too did their prehistoric counterparts. They mainly didn't bother with faces, and instead concentrated on animals, side-on views at that. You can practice endless sweeping curves, drawing bison and running horses. You'll also learn some incongruous facts. Rhinos were running around France 30,000 years ago, engaged in head-butting contests, and our ancestors were drawing pictures of them on cave walls. From a young age, I had always loved the white horse image cut into the chalk at Uffington in Berkshire. A testament to its power is that it is the symbol of the local district council. This was a typical, simplified image, using just a few beautiful lines to create the horse shape. By copying this, years later, when I started drawing, not when I was younger and simply admiring it, I found it fulfilled the micromastery requirement for experimentation. Varying the lines didn't necessarily spoil the picture. It just created new and weird iterations. So you see, identifying a micromastery in any area involves something of a survey, but it need not be too detailed. You should learn the activity's hotspots, and especially the rub-pack barriers central to it. These may be well known, or you may unearth them by reading interviews with practitioners. And once you happen on a micromastery, another one, perhaps a better one, may be just around the corner. Help yourself. Humans are learning animals. We have to be. Each generation must learn a great deal in order to participate fully in life. Then we must learn what is new and urgent in order to survive the inevitable changes that occur throughout our life. Finally, we must keep learning as we age, in order to keep the basic functionality of our brain in working order. Since micromastery is an optimal learning strategy as well as an approach to essaying new subjects for potential study, it has many benefits in the life of a learning human. Your plastic brain. Use it or lose it. We are all hostage to the image we have of the way the brain works. For many years, it was thought that the amount of grey matter in the brain was fixed, and worse, that it more or less deteriorated from the age of 20 onwards. We now know this to be completely false. Neurological growth and improvement can happen throughout life. Dr. Michael Mertzenich, one of the foremost researchers into brain plasticity, writes, "Brain plasticity is a physical process. Grey matter can actually shrink or thicken. Neural connections can be forged and refined, or, conversely, weakened and severed. Changes in the physical brain manifest as changes in our abilities. For example, each time we learn a new dance step, it reflects a change in our physical brains. New wires, neural pathways, that give instructions to our bodies on how to perform the step. Each time we forget someone's name, it also reflects brain change. Wires that once connected to the memory have been degraded or even severed. As these examples show, changes in the brain can result in improved skills, a new dance step, or a weakening of skills, a forgotten name." Dr. Michael Mertzenich, www.onthebrain.com and Softwired, How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Can Change Your Life, Parnassus Publishing, 2013. Never has the phrase, use it or lose it, been better applied than to our plastic brains, which is where the obvious connections with micromastery begin. Because micromasteries are so diverse and so fast to learn, we have the opportunity to keep using our brains, to give them the best possible workout throughout our lives. From an evolutionary perspective, a life oriented around micromastery acquisition is far more natural, i.e., similar to the polymathic lifestyle which our hunter-gatherer forebears experienced, than the curtailed and limited modern experience of mediating life through a computer screen. There is clearly an evolutionary advantage to micromastery, since our brains are wired that way. we unwire them to hyperspecialize at our peril. As we've already mentioned, focal hand dystonia is a debilitating ailment suffered by, among others, classical guitarists. The intense use of one part of the body, the hand and fingers, while the rest remains immobile, rewires the brain to such an extent that it begins to perceive the areas surrounding